to another episode of Textory. Today we are going to talk about studying and university and education. So all that stuff that is maybe not traditionally associated with summer, but maybe that's for the better. Maybe you're already starting to miss your uni and you're like, damn, that was kind of fun. So this episode is probably gonna help you with that education withdrawal. Before we jump into it, just a reminder that I have a Patreon at patreon.com/textory where you can support this podcast and have a look at some additional materials and stuff. So go check that out. Now we're starting today's episode a little bit gay because the author of today's text is Jeanette Augustus Marx. She was a professor of English literature at Mount Holyoke College, and quite unusual for a woman in the Victorian / Edwardian era to be a whole ass professor. It's genuinely, I think it's something that only could have happened in the US or UK at the time, because Europe was a little behind on progress, especially places like, let's say, Poland, because at the time we only began having the first students even allowed to take classes. So we were like years behind. So that's one cool thing about American history, is that they allowed women to study quite early on, and not even just study, but as we can see by Jeanette's example, take up pretty high positions in the academia. So I'm going to post a picture of Jeanette on Patreon because there is this really slay 1890s portrait of her. And then I'm going to post another picture, which is of her and her partner, because in 1899, she met Mary Emma Woolley and they got into a relationship, and that relationship lasted for 48 years until Woolley's death. And it wasn't just some girl, because Mary was the first female student to attend Brown University in 1890. So it's safe to say that they shared common interests of, you know, making history and breaking boundaries for women, which is pretty impressive. It seems like quite a power couple. So we're reading today a book that is called A Girl's Student Days and After from 1911. This is a book by Jeanette, but it has an introduction by Mary, so it's kind of a collaboration of them. Before we jump into the book, I wanted to talk a little bit about the early university students' aesthetic. Obviously, going to university wasn't very common, but it was slowly becoming more common for working class people in the 19th and early 20th century. And I think it's incredible that women were allowed to study practically within a couple of years. For so long, attending a university was something they could only dream of, was something completely unattainable. And then all of a sudden, all those universities started allowing women to study. So all of a sudden, you had this subculture of educated young women. They also had a particular way of dressing. They would often wear shirtwaists and simple dark skirts and neckties and boaters. So they did adapt a style of clothing that was a little bit male fashion inspired, probably to kind of make themselves look more serious in the eyes of the academia, because if they came to the classes dressed in frills and bows and lace, they might not be treated seriously. Here is how common it actually was to study in this period. In 1900, there were 85,000 female college students in the US. So that's over 30% of all students, which I think for 1900 is an incredible number. Because at the same time, UK only had 16% of female students. And they, for example, couldn't earn degrees in Oxford until 1920, so way after that. And in the rest of Europe, it was typically under 5%, so nowhere near the 30% of US students. And I think it's incredible because You cannot help but imagine how badass it must have felt to be one of the first female students in history and how strong that sisterhood must have been. I think it's absolutely mind-blowing. That's one of the reasons I would wish to one time travel back in time just to see that sort of sisterhood that they shared and what it looked like and what it felt like. But luckily, Jeanette comes to the rescue with her book. So today we're going to read a little bit about that. Starting off with The Ideal Freshman. Freshman year, the beginning year, the year of new experiences, new delights, new work, new friends, new surroundings. The year that may mean much to a girl, that may answer some of the questions that have lain long in heart and mind, that will surely reveal her more clearly to herself, that may make her understand others better and help her to guess something of the riddle of the years to come. Here come some of the girls who are entering school and college with her. Bright-haired, dark-haired, rosy or pale, tall or thin, fat and short, clever and average, desirable and undesirable, in fact, all sorts and conditions of girls. There is the student who errs on the side of leading two workaday a life, and in so doing has lost something of the buoyancy and breadth and snap, which would make her associations and her work fresher and more vigorous. The grind, she has been called. Turns out grind is not a modern concept. And if she recognizes herself in this sketch, let her take care to reach out for a bigger and fuller life than she is leading. And there is too the selfish student, whose class spirit is self-spirit. And the girl who is not selfish, but who uses herself up in too many interests, dramatic, athletic, society, philanthropic, and in a dozen others. She is probably over-conscientious, a good girl in every way, but in doing too much, she loses sight of the real aim of her school life. To these must be added another student. The freshman who skims the surface and is, when she gets out, where she was when she entered. No, not quite so far along, for she has slipped back. She is selfish, relying upon the patience and burden-bearing capacity of her father and mother, as well as the school. Okay, so lots of different types of students. I don't know about you, but I'm trying to go through my brain and trying to see what sort of people I went to university with. I definitely remember a lot of the ones that were doing too much, the ones that were studying too much, and the ones that had like 10 different things going on. I don't really remember the ones that entered uni and just left basically being the same and knowing the same, but maybe that's because we were all studying pretty hard. What a girl gets in school will much depend upon what she has to give. No girl is there simply to have a good time or merely to learn things out of books. What do you mean? That was literally me. I was there for a good time, not a long time. I was like passing my grades barely. And I was there to learn and have fun. But I imagine back then when it was such a huge deal to even get there and to pay for it, because unis in Poland are free. I don't know if you know that. I'm assuming back then it was a much bigger deal. So you weren't there just for fun. You were there to gain education and potentially change your life. Nor is she there to fill in the interim between childhood and young womanhood, when one will go into society, another marry, and a third take up some wage-earning career. No, she is there to carry life forward in the deepest, truest sense. And the longer she can have to get an education and to make the best of the opportunities of school and college life, the richer and fuller her after years will be. You can definitely get a taste of Jeanette's views on education here because she seems to consider it quite a deep endeavor and an important thing to do that can literally change your life for the better. So you can definitely tell she was like deep into academia. But also it's a bit sad because nowadays universities and studying and colleges, they just don't carry the same meaning anymore because you're probably going to end up unemployed anyway. So they don't necessarily feel like they're changing your life for the better. They're sort of just postponing the inevitable, which is we are all in trouble. And that's a bit sad to think about. There is a certain social selfishness in the way some students take their opportunities for granted without realizing that there are thousands and hundreds of thousands of girls who would give all that they possess for a tithe of such riches. Also, because of the sacrifice which is being made for them at home, girls are selfish in taking their school or college life carelessly. See, this is what I was talking about. When your course is being paid for by your family at home, you have an immense pressure to do well and to take your studies seriously because otherwise that effort and that sacrifice is going to waste. The school has to bear much of the responsibility for the individual failure. But of this, the student who is failing rarely thinks. Parents hold an institution to blame if it does not do for their child what they expect it to do, when it may be the girl who is at fault. I don't know about uni, but I think there's definitely this approach in regular schools now that when your child is failing, when your child is not maybe doing well education-wise, it has to be the teacher's fault. And I know a lot of people that are teachers and they say it's absolutely exhausting because they are the ones that are expected to correct children's misbehaviors and children's upbringing, basically, even when they're not the ones that brought them up. And it should actually be the responsibility of the parents. And the parents never take that responsibility because they come into school and they're like, you were supposed to fix my child and you didn't. I will tell you one truth about the first year of school life. Friends, there will surely be. And homesickness, there is likely to be. There is considerable danger both ways. Even if a girl has never been away from home before, it is possible that she will not suffer from homesickness. It is probable, however, that the new surroundings in which the girl finds herself and the separation from those who are the center of her personal life will bring on an attack of this most painful malady. It takes time to fit comfortably into the new surroundings, and meanwhile, everything is strange. Homesickness is not to be laughed at, but it must be less deadly, less fatal than some people think it, or there would not be so many recoveries. Girls often weep when they enter school, and then after the long, dreary years are really over, lived through, and the poor, forlorn freshman is metamorphosed into the senior, they weep again. Is it not strange that these seniors who wept on entering school should weep also when leaving it? This is a really good tip, especially if you're going to uni somewhere that's not near your home. I actually experienced this when I went to study in Scotland. Literally the first weekend, I was like, I want to go home. Like, I called my mom crying. I was like, I can't do this. This is so awful. I had a lot of anxiety. And it's strange because I was given an assignment that I was really excited about. And I had a great idea. And I was like, oh, this is so creative. I love this. And then as soon as I was given this assignment, my brain was like, you're not going to make it. This is too much. And you should go home. And my mom picked up, she was like, okay, and she gave me a very sensible tip. She was like, okay, try to make it the first 2 weeks. Try to make it to the end of those first 2 weeks, and then you'll see how you feel. And that was a great tip, because by the end of those 2 weeks, I was so busy with all of the assignments and stuff and meeting new people that I completely forgot I was ever wanting to go home. And after 3 months, I think, I actually did not want to go home for the Christmas break. And over time, obviously, my feelings changed a bit because everything was not that fresh and new and exciting anymore. So by the end of my course, I was fully ready to go back home, but I was not so desperately homesick anymore. And I actually appreciated the city, the country, the landscape, everything. And it's been 10 years now since I studied there, and I still get a bit emotional thinking about that time because it was special. It was truly special. So sorry for this rant. This is going completely off topic now, but if you ever experience homesickness as a student, keep that in mind. Make it to the first 2 weeks. If you make it to the first 2 weeks, make it to the first month. If you make it to the first month, think, has it gotten better? Or is that maybe a sign that no, you should go back home actually and be be in your normal element again? Maybe this is not for you, but give yourself that chance. Friendships. There is no denying that there is great temptation to violent admirations and attractions in school. In the first place, in school or college, the girl is brought into contact with a large circle of people who are immensely interesting to her. The whole atmosphere is full of novelty, of the unusual. Some of the students and teachers whom she meets for the first time represent a broader experience, it may be, than her own home life has given her. These are often new types, and new types are always interesting. Only a few of the friendships made in school are destined to endure. One of the foremost of those that last is founded on similarity of interest. Perhaps it is the girl with whom one has worked side by side in the laboratory. A relation formed slowly and on a permanent basis. Many of the best of friends have come together through community of interests. And this is a type of friendship for which men have a greater gift than women. Okay. All of the hobbies I partook in beg to differ because it's always mostly girls. But also the times have changed. I think nowadays men are much more likely to have hobbies that are kind of lonely. And it's a hot take, but men are just more at home, I feel like. Even if they do get out, it's like maybe with their friends. But men are not big nowadays on hobbies that include large groups of people they don't know. Or am I wrong? This is just my observation from the people I know. There has been a general improvement in student rooms, yet many rooms today have altogether too much in them. Too many pictures, too many banners, too much furniture, too many hangings. The great fault of most rooms is this overcrowding. If we were only heroic enough to make a bonfire of 9/10 of all they contain, we should see suddenly revealed possibilities for something like the ideal room. As a person that constantly has too much in her room, I personally disagree. Do you know what is the most helpful thing you can have in your room, the article without which you cannot live in it at all, no matter how fine the rugs and bric-a-brac may be? Air. Air is the one thing which is almost instantly and absolutely indispensable to human life. For we breathe it in not only through our noses, but also all over our skin. Another fun story from my time of studying in Scotland. Within like maybe the first week, my window completely broke. I just couldn't close it at all. So once I finally closed it, I managed to close it. I was like, I'm not opening this up again because I don't want to live with an open window. So I closed it, but it was so messed up that there was a gap and it was really drafty and windy. So I bought cotton, like, you know, the cotton that's used for like cotton buds. I stuffed that gap with cotton and then I taped it in place with duct tape. And that was my window for a year. I could not air out my room. I could not open the window. I dealt with it. I mean, the room was stuffy anyway because they have those stupid carpets everywhere and it was pretty small. So whenever I wanted some air in my room, I would have to open kitchen window and then hopefully some of that air would come into my room. But obviously that was not the case. So for a year straight, I could not open my window. And then my dad came over to help me pack when I was finishing up the studies. And he bloody fixed that window within like maybe 5 minutes of entering my room. And I was so pissed because I was like, great, Could have done it over video perchance, and that would result me not living in a smelly, stuffy room for a year straight. But I mean, you know, now I've learned. So, well, at least I don't do that anymore. I don't have to tape my windows in. But if I ever had to, I would probably ask my dad first. What is the meaning of the room, which is your school center for the time being? It is an intimate place where a girl may have her friends and good times. It is a retreat and it is a workshop. It is the girl's home center away from home, the place from which she will lead her life, in its expression attractive or unattractive, like her or unlike her. Get good materials and good colors. They need not be expensive. Remember that colors have to go together just as furniture has to do. To have styles of furniture that clash or colors that do not harmonize will negate any care which the student may have taken in the selection of individual pieces or materials. This is an aspect of being a student that I don't think is that relevant anymore, because modern students are mostly broke, A. B, they usually stay in accommodations that don't really allow too much interference with the interior. You can't really put nails in the wall. You don't really get to pick furniture. You don't really get to decorate your space the way you wish for. So this is something that I don't think is adequate anymore. The joy of work. If one is in good condition, the exercise of any physical power is a pleasure. It is a pleasure to run, to sing, to dance, to climb mountains, to row, to swim. It is a pleasure to shout for nothing else than the pure joy of letting off surplus energy. But the highest power of which human beings are possessed is not the power of the body. It is the power of the mind. Our schools and colleges today are very much richer in the joy of everything else. In beautiful surroundings, in freer and fuller athletic and outdoor life, in a more varied and delightful social life than they were 50 or even 25 years ago. But it is a question whether the joy of intellectual work has kept pace with this joy of life in its other aspects. I'm actually not sure what she's on about here. From the school to the girl. There is another matter at which the school in placing its students must look. To be a desirable candidate for a good position, a girl need not be expensively gowned, but she must be daintily and freshly dressed. So they're talking about trying to find a position after being a student. So you've been a female student in the 1900s, you have graduated, now you are trying to enter the workforce, and it must have been an immense task. It must have been incredibly hard, and I'm assuming 90% of women just went back to their hometowns and just, you know, settled down because it was near to impossible to be employed. But in case they were trying to do so, here is a little guide on how to look and how to behave. Immaculate shirt waist, a plain, well-made skirt with good shoes, stockings, and gloves, and a quiet, pretty hat are all any woman needs in meeting her business obligations. And that daintiness which she shows in her dress, she must show in her person too, in clean skin and fingernails, good teeth, and smooth, attractively arranged hair. What the school is able to do for the girl depends very largely upon the girl herself. The majority of people with whom she comes in contact do not take that into consideration, and the school is held unfairly responsible for the girl. All any school can do is to use the material it finds. Someone has said with harsh but true emphasis that a college does not make a fool. It simply helps in the development of one. As an illustration of its limitations, a school sends out two girls from the same class. One girl it is too proud to have taken as a type. The other it is sorry to have represented. Yet both have been under exactly the same influence. Students do not realize how fearfully at their mercy a school is, or that, so far as reputation is concerned, it is they who make or mar its credit. So the last bit here is a disclaimer that you as a person that have studied at a particular uni or college or whatever you call it, or an educational institution, you serve as sort of a calling card of that institution, and people will judge the institution by coming in contact with you. So it says, you know, your conduct will affect the school's reputation, which is interesting because I don't think it's something that we do nowadays. I don't think we care. I mean, we may judge the school's system or level of education by coming in contact with many people that have attended that school, but we just assume as a person it's not their uni, obviously, because it's completely out of the control of the uni, the type of people that they put out. But I also imagine back then it was more about you are a female graduate and you need to behave accordingly because people will judge you and people will be very observant of how you behave and how intelligent you are, because obviously everyone is questioning whether or not women should be part of that education system, and you are a testament to women in that system. So I'm assuming maybe that's what she's talking about here. Anyway, that was the last bit of the book. Let me know what you think. And any students here, by the way, I am way past my student days. I think it's almost 10 years now since I fully graduated and never went back to college or uni. It's not that fresh in my memory, but I have found a lot of things and themes that I recognize and I still remember. So I wonder what it's like for people that are studying now, and what similarities or differences did you find in the text, and what sort of thoughts you have on that, preferably female students, because that's more on point for this. Anyway, shout out to Jeanette and Mary, who seem like a real power couple. Go to my Patreon at patreon.com/textry to check out their really cute couple picture from 1924, I think, so a little bit later than the book. And I'll hear you in another episode. Bye.